Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, oh, O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's Halloween, October the 31st, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, in addition to our annual Halloween musical selection, we have a lot of email questions this week. I tell you what, let's get the grim and depressing part over with first this week. Now, I got a couple of emails recently of a kind that I get a lot. People are asking me about other white nationalists in an effort to find out just who the hell they can trust, who is lying to them, and whom it might be inadvisable to associate with. Now, I'm going to read these emails to you now in somewhat edited versions to remove any names as required by the Prime Directive. First off, this is from Devon in Michigan. Dear HAC, do you know any local reputable white nationalist leaders' contact information? I need to run a word-of-mouth background on some individuals in the movement to see if they are who they claim to be. As with everything on the Internet, we have to be vigilant to know if we're getting the real story. Do you know how to contact so-and-so, signed Devon? Oh, and I get that a lot as well, people begging for the names and contact information of local people in their area within reasonable driving distance, somebody who will actually meet with them off-Internet. Now, we have people in our wee little movement who have been internet dabbling for years and who have never actually met another white nationalist in person. They're like mole in Wind in the Willows, very shy and hard to coax out of their warm, safe little burrows underground. I believe a few weeks ago I got into the email list on here and what happened with that. Anyway, moving right along. Second email is from Roy in Australia. Dear HAC, time and again we hear you say that nobody else in the white movement is doing anything other than the NF. What then is your opinion on so-and-so and his grouplet? They are out there in the real world doing something, if only providing a voice of resistance against the vile anti-white system in America. Do they have a plan other than to resist? Create a homeland for white people? Perhaps not. But they are at least trying to reach the whites across America and facing the enemy, much like George Lincoln Rockwell used to do, signed Roy. Okay, first off, as it happens, yes, I do know the current status of so-and-so number one, and I updated Devon on that status. I get that a lot, people in our tiny little movement disappearing and going dark on the Internet, and then others come to me looking to contact them or find out where they disappeared to. I'm kind of like a lost and found department in some respects. Sometimes I can help, but a lot of times I can't, because when people go dark, they usually go dark on me too. Most times it's for mundane reasons, like the guy's on the run from the bill collectors or his ex-wife's lawyer, or he lost his job and he had to move back into his parents' basement or under a bridge or something like that. Now remember, we are living in Obama's America. People have it rough. America is an unstable and fluid society at best, and 6 years of Obama has made it a lot worse. Now, this is an old problem that we have, people simply disappearing, and it's one reason that we need to live in communities, so that when it happens and one of us drops out of sight, somebody can go over and pound on the door and find out if the guy's dead or in jail or what. Secondly, the people that Roy from Australia was asking about are the last group of guys who wear Third Reich costumes in public. Let's leave it at that. I can't very well criticize that, since I myself did the same thing for the first 8 years of my political career. But I keep hoping that when this last bunch loses interest and wanders off, we'll finally be able to bury that little practice. The problem there is that when you get into costumery and public butt-showing with signs and all, you don't attract national socialists. What you attract are people who want to wear Nazi uniforms, and those are not the same thing. Now, let me explain what I'm rabbiting on about here. I get emails and letters all the time from people all over the world asking me, what do I think of so-and-so, and what is the story on this movement personality, or what really happened in such-and-such an incident? This is because people think, with my decades of experience, I might know the truth. And yeah, more often than not, I do. And people trust me to actually tell them the truth, which is where it gets a bit tricky. Because as you know, some of you anyway know, back many years ago, I developed a habit of shouting certain inconvenient truths from the rooftops. Truths that needed to be heard, and I still think needed to be heard, but anyway, 25 years later, I'm still being stalked on the internet for it. I think I got into this a little bit last week in that canned piece from several years ago that I slept in when I got rushed, but let me run this down for you guys again. Now, there is a myth in our wee little subculture here that there is something called white unity. Now, in real life, it doesn't exist. I'm sure most of you have noticed by now that the majority of the main white nationalist personalities on the internet spend most of their time slandering and vilifying and undermining one another, which has become much more obvious since the movement left the real world and became an online phenomenon. Why do they do this? Yes, they have psychological and emotional problems, all right, but okay, I'll tell you the main reason why. The simple fact is that the dozen or so main movement personalities most of you would be familiar with are all chasing the same buck, as the late Dr. William Pierce put it. Or as Bill White puts it, we are all competing for market share, and the media blackout makes sure it's a damn small market. If we were ever able to break the blackout and start getting into the white community as such instead of just chatting and talking with each other all the time on Stormfront and whatnot, and all of a sudden the pool of potential support and the potential audience were to widen into the hundreds of thousands and millions of people, then it would probably be a different story. But what can I tell you? We're all fighting for the biggest piece of a very small pie. This, for example, is why any mention of me or my novels or the NF or anything Northwest is now forbidden on Stormfront, VNN, White News Now, and so forth and so on. Because to their webmasters, we are the competition. The NF has an actual idea, a strategy that will work if I can ever get anybody interested in actually doing all this. No one else has that. All they've got is a computer bulletin board, and it drives them batshit with rage and jealousy. The Northwest Front offers actual, real-world action if any of you ever decide that you want to engage in any, and the computer bulletin boards can't compete with that. All they are is words. Also, we have the Northwest Novels, the best white fiction in the movement, with the usual ritual deferment to Turner Diaries. I do still make that ritual genuflection, although I've had people tell me flat out that Turner Diaries was the first, not the best. Well, that's up to you guys to judge, but those books of mine drive these petty movement figures into a screaming, hissy fit of jealousy. So either we're completely banned from mention, or when we are mentioned, we get slimed by the board owners or the moderators. But the overwhelming amount of bona fide so-called movement infighting, by which I mean actual feuding between our guys and not shit stirred by cognitive dissonance agents on the internet, is based on competition for the donation dollar. What, would you rather I lied to you? I'd like to tell you I would never do that, but I do lie to you all the time by omission, by not naming all of the bad and sometimes really wretched things going on in this movement that I just don't tell you about because it serves no purpose, it's demoralizing, and it's counterproductive. I'm tempted to go off into a long personal digression here about my own history with this kind of thing, but that would serve no purpose. Suffice it to say that there seems to be a kind of prime directive in play here, and I can't really tell you where it came from or how it developed, but it seems to run something like this. I and other people can talk about white character problems in the broad and general sense. Now, we pretty much have to do that because the character issue has now become so obvious to everybody involved in white nationalism that it simply can't be swept under the rug anymore. Anyway, there seems to have arisen some kind of weird unwritten law that we can talk about character so long as we keep it vague and general, but we cannot name actual names or cite specific dates, places, times, and incidents. Now, if we name names, then we are fighting a feud, quote-unquote. We are, quote-unquote, attacking somebody, or we are sinning against that mythical white unity that has never really existed. This movement doesn't cope with legitimate criticism very well. The movement has no concept of loyal opposition. Movement people all have skins as thin as tissue paper, and the slightest criticism is taken as an excuse for a lifelong blood feud to the death via internet and slander and open letters and the whole usual goo-boo garbage. I think this is because our movement is so small, and so many people have track records of multiple groups and affiliations that when you name a name in a public forum of any kind, there will almost certainly be somebody in the audience who is a former cult follower of Personality X or Guru Y, and who either still believes in that guru's inspired mission or whatever, or else he was fooled by the guy for some years and he dropped a ton of money on him, and he did not see this particular guru on a white horse with his saber drawn leading the charge on CNN, which is what we appear to expect of our fearless leaders. And so he feels all embittered and embarrassed, so forth and so on, and he doesn't appreciate you bringing up old memories. Look, in defense of all of my fellow fearless leaders in the white nationalist movement, past and present, good or bad, people... no one, not me, not anybody, can give you what you want. What you want is to turn on your television sets to CNN or Fox News and watch the revolution on TV while you sit on the sofa swilling Pabst Blue Ribbon and crunching on salty snacks. Of course you do. You are Americans. That is what you have been conditioned from birth to believe politics is, a spectator sport that you watch on TV like you watch a nigger football game. You come to me and you ask me what I think about so-and-so. So let me give you a canned answer. There are four, maybe five fearless leaders in our movement's history whom I consider to have been genuinely bad men. Men whom I felt I had to warn people against. None of them are alive today except one, and he's now only a ghost on the internet. He flits inconsequentially between the tombstones on VNN and rattles his chains every now and then. I've even mellowed on Matt Cale. I never thought that would happen, but it did. I still don't like the way he played out, but having now walked a few decades in his shoes, I've come to understand why Cale did some of the things he did. You ask what I think of so-and-so. I'll tell you what I most likely think of so-and-so. I think he's a guy who started out filled with the spirit of the 14 words and who beat his head bloody against a brick wall for years. A voice of desperate illumination, frantic to get you to listen to him and, more importantly, to act on what you know. Until one day the crushing realization hit him that he was just talking to himself. And that you people are never, ever going to do anything. It killed his spirit, and after that he simply disappeared, or else he went on playing it for the money or playing it for the laughs. Now there you have the story of most white nationalist leaders for the past 60 years. It hasn't killed my spirit yet, although I'm not quite sure how I can prove that. I'm not playing it for laughs, and God knows not for the money, as anyone who has ever visited me knows. The devil of all this is that I could give you what you want if you'll help me. I am, in fact, quite willing to mount my white horse and draw my saber and lead the charge with my cape flapping in the wind. But you are going to have to give me the horse and the saber and the cape, And then you're going to have to pack a moving van and come here to the Pacific Northwest, and you're going to have to stand behind me and charge behind me. That world that you see in my novels, you can have it if you want. It's yours. You can take it, but it won't be given to you. And that's enough of me rambling and babbling about characters, so here's Andy to give you some more of the same.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. This week, I'm going to cover White Character Step 3, the footwork portion of the White Character task. White Character footwork is the natural outgrowth of deciding what you need to change about yourself. That, along with quite a few other things I've said in my White Character discussions, is not a shocking revelation. That's because, at some point, you are actually going to have to do this stuff if you want to see any results. When I spoke about Step 1, I provided the only motivation you're going to need, assuming you're sincere. Northwest Migration represents the first time the white nationalist movement has genuinely asked anything of our comrades, and therefore it's the first time you've all been told to actually do something. That's still quite new for a few of you, especially the old movement hands hearing it. I get it. But what you need to grasp is that the only way to truly fix up your character is to participate in the one workable plan to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And no, I'm not just saying that. Obeying the Northwest Imperative is the only way we're going to get out of this on an individual and racial level. And on that note, I'm going to have to go over the White Character Microcosm Revolutionary Party Macrocosm again. Several times in the past, I've noted that in order to revolt against Zog, we must all first revolt against ourselves. And once again, no, I'm not just saying that. The choices we've made as a race, as a movement, and as individuals are standing in our way, and before we do anything else, we've got to become people who aren't ever going to do these things again. If we can't do that, we're not ever going to stand a chance of mounting any real resistance of any sort. Our movement, for reasons too numerous to discuss right now, has waited far too long in the hopes that something other than our current predicament would materialize. That didn't work out, so the only thing left to do is accept the mess we're in and decide to do something about it. The catch here is that the only thing left to do is carve off the Pacific Northwest for our own. There's not anything else, and there isn't going to be anything else. Now follow me on this microcosm-macrocosm thing. Making the choice to migrate is making the choice for the Northwest American Republic. That's the step one microcosm-macrocosm. Taking assessment of yourself as you are in comparison to who you need to be is the choice to adopt the strategy required to secure the NAR. That's the step two, big picture, small picture symmetry. Step three is the footwork required to implement the chosen strategy or action. It's prep. It's not glamorous, and it's certainly not entertainment by itself. In fact, it's usually downright difficult and sometimes discouraging. Always remember the motivational purpose behind making these changes to your characters. It's what will make you the people required to bring the Northwest American Republic into existence. If you accept any other standard as your own, you're not going to have what you need to get yourself through the preparation to come home. Anything else amounts to entertainment value, and when that runs out, you'll get bored and wander off. That being the case, why not just suck it up and accept that you're going to have to participate in Northwest migration, even if it's just to keep up some semblance of authentic white nationalism? Step 2 could be described as giving mental assent to the reality that you're going to have to give up your version of the American dream. In that vein of thought, Step 3 would manifest as the beginning stages of actually doing so. The real work of homecoming preparation is to let go of whatever is keeping you where you are. Those who do migrate, and we hear from more of them all the time, have families, homes, and lives where they come from. Well, most of them, but hey, it might be more virtuous not to get along in the pit, which is modern-day America. Anyhow, it's important to remember we're not asking anything of you we haven't done first. None of the things a person has to deal with while migrating are as delightful as fantasizing about killing our enemies while reading one of the Northwest Independence novels, but they're not the impossibilities migration detractors claim them to be. I'm going to see if I can't deal with the major gripes today. The two big objections are housing and jobs. Housing is a funny thing, because statistically speaking, a very large portion of the people who tune in bought their homes at the height of the bubble and are now in real trouble. But I need to point something out about this that has bothered me for a very long time. Quite a few of these very same people claim to have been racial for a long time, and I'm very willing to believe them. But if they're such old hands at this white nationalism thing, surely they were smart enough to see what was going on, even in the early stages of the housing bubble. Don't get me wrong, guys, I'm not trying to make you feel bad for making the wrong choice, but on some level, you've got to admit what you did was incredibly foolish and own up to the consequences. Even if you're not in that particular segment of the listener base, you're going to have to deal with your problem somehow, and that probably means losing the house. I can only point out that you might be able to get out of your situation without taking a total loss by finding a seller, and if you're underwater on the mortgage, you do have the option of a short sale, provided you can get the bank to go along with it. That's obviously easier said than done, but it is possible. You're going to have to stay on their case about it, likely to the point of getting advice from someone in the know on how to convince the bank to cooperate with you, but the option does exist. Quick disclaimer, I'm not an expert on this topic, so consult someone who is. If you know you're about to lose the house anyway, it would be better to submit to reality so that you can start adjusting your life right now. The best thing for you might be to get the weight off your shoulders anyway, since the only thing to do is come home. Even for those who aren't in a bad way with their homes, the best thing to do is exercise a bit of forethought and realize the American dream has turned into a nightmare, so much so that it will affect everyone, you included. Get out while you can and come help the party secure an existence for our people and a future for white children. It's much easier to take care of this sort of thing now rather than later, since the possibility will have passed you by. The job situation is actually a bit of good news in the homeland. Yeah, okay, not all of you are in the homeland, but hear me out on this. I've been looking for a way to get this bit of news on RFN, and now's the perfect time. Some months ago, it became known that Seattle, out of the whole country, is number one in recent months for job growth and number two in the last 4 years for wage growth. We're doing all right. If you can get here and you have the ability to work, you're going to be able to do so. You'll be better off if you've put the time in to learn to offer an employer something unique, and even better yet if you're able to sustain yourself in some way. Okay, that doesn't quite deal with migration itself, but it's a light at the end of the tunnel. Here's the deal with jobs where you are. You have to have one, even if you're not a white nationalist or trying to come home, so don't act like the Northwest Front expects superhuman effort from you. You're going to have to feed, clothe, and house yourself no matter what, so why not just deal with it? Multiple times in my life, even after I had a college degree, I had to take some awful jobs in order to stay in the game. At one of them, I was regularly up to my ankles in the excrement I had to shovel. And no, that's not a euphemism. When I talk about improving yourself and doing the right thing because it's the right thing, I know what I'm talking about. If you're in such awful shape where you are, suck it up. Do whatever job you can and get however many of them you need so that you can eventually come here and do even better for yourself. We get organic migrants to the Northwest all the time who are moving out here just for their own selfish interests. There's no reason you can't do the same and more. Hail victory, comrades.
Okay, it's Halloween, and we traditionally have mystical, magical, ghostly music on this week. No, I'm not going to play Monster Mash, but here's one from the 50s, which I actually remember hearing on the radio at Halloween when I was a very small child. No, really. This is Gene Simmons.
I just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bells started ringing and chain ran loud. Knew I'd moved in a haunted house. Still I made up my mind to stay. Nothing wasn't gonna drive me away. When I seen something to give me the creep. Had a one big eye and a two big feet. Stood right still and I did the freeze. He did a stroll right up to me. Made a noise with the feet that sound like a drum. Say you be here when the morning comes. Say yes, I'll be here when the morning comes. Be right here and ain't gonna run. I bought this house and you know I'm boss. Ain't gonna run me off. In my kitchen my stove was a blazing hot. Coffee was a boiling in the pot. The grease had melted in my hand. Had a hunk of meat in my hand. From outer space there sat a man. On the hot stove with the pots and say that's hot, I began to shout. Drink a hot coffee right from the spout. He ate the raw meat right from my hand. I drank a hot grease with a frying pan. looked at me and said, you better run. Don't be here when the morning comes. Say yes, I'll be here when the morning comes. I'll be right here and I ain't gonna run. I bought this house and you know I'm bald.
Right, let's take an interlude now for some more history of our own movement, just so you guys come to understand that, yes, we really do have a history besides the Klan and shaven-headed drunks in tattoos waving beer cans in the air and screaming white power. No really long speeches this week, just a few short audio clips from some of the more obscure racial personalities who a lot of you have probably never heard of, beginning with Dr. Edward R. Fields of Marietta, Georgia. Dr. Fields was the head of the National States Rights Party, and also for many years he was editor of a newspaper called Thunderbolt, which changed its name around the early 80s to The Truth at Last, and which was probably the best tabloid newspaper for mass distribution that the racial nationalist cause ever had. This is a short clip from a speech made by Dr. Edward Fields at a special rally in Knoxville, Tennessee in June 2007. This rally was held to commemorate Shannon Christian and her boyfriend, who were murdered by niggers in one of the most brutal racial hate crimes in this country's history. And when Doc made this speech, he was in his mid-70s.
White violent crime up 20%? No, my friends. 100% of the increase in violent crime in America is black. South Africa was a great, thriving, peaceful, law-abiding nation until 1995, when current leaders at that time, who were bought off by the CIA, British intelligence, sold out the country and turned it over to Nelson Mandela, who didn't deserve all the praise that he got. Since then, law and order has collapsed in South Africa. 70 people every single day are murdered in South Africa. Every 26 seconds in South Africa, a woman or a girl is raped. South Africa is the AIDS capital of the world. Nearly 1 million whites have now fled South Africa. And also, it's interesting to know that 20% of the blacks wish that apartheid was back because it was a much safer place to live and they had better jobs, health care, and everything else. South Africa is the number one murder capital of the world. Brazil, which is 60% black, is number two in the world. The United States is number three. In all three countries, black crime predominates. One other thing I want to mention, which I think is important. Shannon Christian. 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 Christopher Newsom. Christ. Both victims have their name of Jesus Christ as part of their name. Both had Christ in their name. Both of them had been crucified by these three brutal savages. Crucified, actually, in the name of the white race. I had a letter the other day from a lady here in Knoxville that says, please, Dr. Fields, don't let this case be forgotten. And that's why we're here today. Christ is who we believe in. Christ will save us. These two Christians died horrible, tragic, torturous deaths as Jesus Christ died on the cross. They were crucified. It's up for us, up to us, to carry on our beliefs in segregation of the races, which is best for both races. The blacks had a much higher standard of living. They were much safer under white segregation rule here in the South. I can remember as a child, I worked at the Fox Theater in downtown Atlanta as an usher during the 1950s. I could walk through a black neighborhood any hour of the night without any fear of being attacked, mugged, or whatever. And my parents never once ever told me, be careful walking through a black neighborhood at night. Back then, 80% of all blacks with children were married. Today it's 20%. Again, society is collapsing, and it's getting worse every day. I want to thank all of you for coming, and I hope to see you again in the near future. Thank you so much.
J. James Mason. Okay. James Mason was and is a problematic character in our movement's history. I'm not going to detail that story here. I will simply say that in Mason was some good and a lot of goo-boo. Now, that having been said, he did publish one book called Siege, which is a collection of his writings, which is well worth ordering and reading, especially if you're a student of movement history of that period. I'm sure you guys can find it online somewhere, and I know that there are printed editions floating around Amazon and Libris, so forth and so on. Now, this is a reading from a section of Mason's book, Siege. I do not know if this is Mason himself reading it or who. The voice sounds familiar. I almost want to say I've had this person on here before, but I can't recognize it off the top of my head. It might be Mason himself, but it's just been so long and people change so much over the decades that I'm not sure I'd recognize Mason's voice if I heard it again. Anyway, here it is.
I am compelled at this time to add my voice to those few who have demanded that such things as Phase 1 type activities must stop. Simply such nonsense as trying to make headlines, confront the enemy, or rally the white masses won't work, never has worked, and almost always results in merely revealing our weaknesses and making us look like idiots. The very strategy itself calls for numbers, which we do not have at this time. My view is that just because the Jews and the liberals have succeeded in making goyim out of the vast majority of whites, we need not sacrifice ourselves in the vain attempt at proving them wrong. We have got to trash can the 1933 strategies and tactics. They won't work. For a decent street demonstration, you must have anywhere from 50 to 100 uniformed and disciplined troopers. We have managed 50 on several occasions, and 100 on only one occasion. For the rest, it is pitiful and ineffectual, futile, counterproductive, and I might add, costly and dangerous. As much as I hate to see a good comrade wounded in such useless actions, I hate worse to see the sacrifice of millions of lives in World War II that went into building the terrific reputation that we have enjoyed and are now wasting as these Laurel and Hardy stunts gradually destroy our image. We don't have to set ourselves up for big letdowns. The enemy does that for us. I will admit, right here, that it does require guts to stage these demonstrations. The tragedy that we can no longer tolerate is that those guts are wasted in this manner. Doing it the way it's been done in the past gives the enemy full advantage of his power and places us at the mercy of our own weaknesses. It's got to stop now. First, never announce your plans in any manner whatsoever. Second, forget about the use of uniforms unless and until you have a standing army of your own numbering 50 as a flat minimum. From experience, I know that with 50 National Socialists, one can do anything, anywhere, anytime. Better still, as Tomasi said, forget such activities as might be used in a campaign to gain political power. Rather, go instead to activities designed and intended to hurt the enemy. And for these activities, in my opinion, two participants are one too many. Also, in my humble opinion, it is a ridiculous risk and waste to mess with the material body of the enemy, as he has all our tax money to mend himself, just as a lizard will grow a new limb. The physical body of the enemy, however, is so utterly flabby that he positively can't stand very much of an intensified assault of this kind. In short, it would seem to me that any intelligence at all would lead comrades to know to stop hitting the enemy where he laughs and start hitting him where he screams. Strike hard, strike deep, to build the climate for revolution, where even the most craven of white cowards will be compelled to join in or else die. But for God's sakes, stop wasting yourselves and your efforts and making the rest of us look like damn idiots.
And finally, here's Comrade Jack from New Zealand with a Kiwi twist to an old, old story.
Greetings, comrades. I'm Jack from New Zealand. Today I'd like to talk a little bit about my experience with waking up, so to speak, and how it applies to all of us. I know that we don't like to use the term waking up, because we know that there's no magic set of words that will make someone wake up on the spot and realize that we actually know what we're talking about. But the term generally just means the point where we fully came to realize our own beliefs. Now, when I woke up, when I first became a white nationalist, it was scary, and I ended up acting pretty stupid. I didn't want to be a white nationalist, and I still don't. It's hard to live with. The problem with the truth is that it doesn't care about how it makes you feel. It just is what it is. The first thing I did when I became a white nationalist was panic. I felt like I needed to do something drastic to ensure the survival of my people, and I was all alone. I didn't know anybody I could talk to or anywhere I could go. Now, this is where I started to act pretty stupid. I contacted the only group that I could find, a skinhead group that operates nationwide in New Zealand, or so they claim. They're called the Right Wing Resistance, which is funny since I didn't know National Socialism was right wing. I went to a couple of their meetings and were exactly what I expected, a bunch of drunk, illiterate morons who just said nigga 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 over and over again but never really did anything. They cared more about their skinhead culture, their shaved heads and their boots, than they did about their own race. I tried reasoning with them, but that always led to arguments, and since I was a scrawny white boy surrounded by a bunch of skinhead thugs, I figured it wasn't such a good idea. However, I quickly floated to the top of their organization, probably because I was the only white kid with at least 2 brain cells to rub together. I had frequent meetings with their leader, who is a fat, illiterate old man who has the writing skills of a dyslexic 8-year-old, and I would know since I was quickly put in charge of editing the party newsletters. These newsletters were distributed nationwide and were analyzed by the media and every liberal and anti-racist every time they came out, which was about every month or so. I was so disgusted by these people that I was put off completely from any sort of activity. I retreated and just forgot about white nationalism for a while, playing video games and drinking all day, because that's basically what everyone seems to fall back on as an escape. I didn't give up the beliefs or go back to being a happy-go-lucky liberal. I just tried not to think about it for a while. On top of that, I soon descended into the bizarre world of conspiracy theories. Now, I'd like to think that I'm a smart man, but I was fully taken over by the dumbest conspiracy theories you can think of, probably because of the state of mind I was in. I spent all day on a conspiracy forum, and every week I was counting down the days until the next doomsday date, and the planet X would arrive and invade Earth, and no, I'm not making this up. Although, it seems that this seems to be quite a common thing for many white nationalists, because we seem to be on the fringe, and we are often associated with conspiracy theorists, I guess. Eventually, though, I had some sense knocked into me, and it was around this time that I met Connor from Australia. He was on an episode of RFN a couple weeks back, ranting about feminism. When I first met him, he introduced me to the Northwest Front, and I had the knee-jerk reaction of anger and denial. I said things like, oh, that'll never work, won't America just nuke you if they win, and things like that. But the thing is, the Northwest Republic gets talked about a lot on websites like 4chan, where they think that we're just a bunch of neo-Nazi skinheads with a crackpot scheme, and we have no idea what we're doing. And this is where I first heard about the Northwest Front, so that's why I reacted to it the way I did. And this is where most people are introduced to the Northwest Front. But slowly I became more intrigued. I started to read the books, I listened to the podcast every week, and I got myself a copy of the Northwest Republic Constitution. And from that point on, I was excited. I'd finally found what I was looking for. An organization with people who actually had a plan and who aren't content with just sitting at their computers being keyboard warriors. When I woke up for the first time, I had the horrible gut feeling that I had to do something, that I wasn't just content with sitting around. I lost all sense of my own ambitions and desires because I felt that there is nothing more important than my race, that my ancestors fought for hundreds of thousands of years so that I could be here, and it's up to me to make sure that that legacy does not end with myself. And that's how I ended up with groups like the Right Wing Resistance. What I just can't understand is why I seem to be the only one who feels like this most of the time. Whenever I meet someone online who calls themselves a white nationalist, they always seem to have the attitude of, stay the course. Just keep playing the video games, keep arguing online with Jews and communists, and eventually all of our problems will just be solved on their own, and we'll have secured the existence of our race without even having to go outside. I literally cannot wrap my mind around it, how you could know what we know and not even be compelled to lift a finger. And this doubly applies to you Americans who already live in the United States and don't even have to worry about how they're going to immigrate and not get themselves deported, since you already have American citizenship. Well, that's about all I have to say about this subject today, so I'll quit rambling. Hail victory, comrades. 1488.
One of the most common supernatural phenomena throughout the North American continent is so-called ghost lights or phantom lights. There are a number of very famous such lights. These are mysterious glowing orbs or illuminations of various kinds that look like small flames, headlights, whatever, that simply appear out of nowhere and have no visible cause. Just for the record, I myself do not believe that these lights are supernatural. I think that they're some kind of natural phenomenon which we just haven't figured out the explanation for yet. But the fact is, there are a lot of them. Some of the most famous lights are the Marfa lights in Texas. And back home in North Carolina, we have the Mako light and the Brown Mountain lights, which I myself have seen, both of them. Now, the Mako light is pretty obviously some kind of swamp gas or something. That's down near Leland. You walk down the track and you'll see it looks like about 100, 120 or so yards ahead of you. And you keep on walking, and then all of a sudden it's gone, and you turn around, and there it is behind you. So obviously it's some kind of gas-related or reflective phenomenon. It doesn't really appear to move. It's just kind of there. Brown Mountain lights up near Morganton are different. They kind of flicker, and they go out. It's like on a good night when they're out, you can look up on a mountain, and you'll see this flickering glow, like almost like somebody lit a candle up there. Pretty big candle, obviously. And it flickers for a bit, and then it goes out, and then another one will flicker up somewhere. And at some points, you have 5, 6, 7 of these lights flickering and sort of dancing up and down the mountain and the top of the ridgeline and so forth. Again, I think this is some kind of natural phenomenon having to do with methane or whatever, but still, it's a very weird thing to see. It mostly seems to happen in the autumn. It's not like they're shy. I mean, these are real. It's gotten to the point where the North Carolina Department of Highways has actually built overlooks where you pull over and park your car and watch the lights at night. They're that regular. So this is not just something that somebody's made up. These do occur. I personally don't think there's anything ghostly about it, but of course, our ancestors had a different view. This is Wes Miller.
Covered wagon, when they camped on the flats for the night, with the moon shining dim on the old canyon trim, they watched for that brown mountain light. High on the mountain and deep in the canyons below, it shines like the crown of an angel and fades as mist comes and goes. Way over yonder, night after night until dawn, a lonely old slave comes back from the grave, searching, searching, searching for his master who's long gone on. Southern planters came hunting in this wide world alone. It was in the day saying that the planter lost his way and he never returned to his home. His trusting old slave brought a lantern and they searched day and night but in vain. Now the old slave is gone but his spirit lingers on and the lantern it still casts light. High on the mountain and deep in the canyon below, it shines like the crown of an angel and fades as the mist comes and goes. Way over yonder, night after night until dawn, a lonely old slave comes back from the grave, searching, searching, searching and faith has missed how to go. Way up yonder, nine after nine until dawn, a lonely old slave comes back from the grave, searching, searching, searching for his master who's long gone on.
Okay, let's hit those emails. Here's yet another one from Devin in Michigan. Dear HAC, forgive the casual style, but I found some positive developments in my ability to migrate. Young white male in his early 20s with few assets and no skills may be able to learn a skill and start moving if things go as planned. At most, if this new opportunity works out, we'll be able to talk real scouting trip in 12 months or less. How much resources should one save to make a responsible move? The figure will affect when I'm ready to talk about the next steps. Thanks in advance, Devin. Okay, we do get quite a few inquiries, at least, from young single white men of the kind that I refer to as the T-shirt youth. Young men with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs, who are completely destitute and footloose. Now, sometimes this is their fault, because they basically dicked off in school and never learned a trade, or maybe dropped out because they just couldn't stand the niggers and the bullshit, and so they ran away, as white boys have been socially engineered to do. Sometimes it genuinely isn't their fault. Their folks lost their own jobs and homes to the Obama Depression, and these T-shirt youth have no parents' basement to live in. And for whatever reason, they can't get into the military, which is the young, poor, and unskilled white boy's last resort for a job under Obama. For example, I have had a number of inquiries down through the years from T-shirt youth asking about the quality of homeless shelters in the Seattle area. There is now a whole subculture of homeless, young, or comparatively young white boys who haven't quite become winos or drug addicts yet, and who access northwestfront.org through computers in public libraries. I don't know what the situation is in Devin's case, or if any of this applies to him at all. Maybe it doesn't. I do know this. If we were Aryan nations and we had a bunkhouse with a free mattress and a refrigerator full of free food, I could have 50 guys up here next week. Of course, what kind of quality they would be, and whether they would be any use at all, I don't know. I'm not sure what use Pastor Butler ever actually made of all those kids that used to hang out at his place, and I know they caused a lot of trouble, both within the compound itself and among the local people out there in Hayden Lake. Now, without going off into a long spiel about it, that bunkhouse was, in my opinion, more trouble than it was worth. More recently, April Gady found out that letting people walk into her home off the internet and bunk down in her guest room wasn't such a hot idea. So we're going to have to stick with the Northwest Front's basic policy of insisting that you come to the Northwest homeland on your own steam and that you have enough money in your kick so that you can get set up here and live on a very basic level while you look for a job. In fact, April wrote a leaflet for the Northwest Front, which we still send out in our initial introductory packets. And you'd be amazed at how many people lose interest, and we never hear from them again, when they discover that no one is coming down from the sky to whisk them away to the homeland without their ever having to pack a single cardboard box. It seems to my senile memory that I read out part of that leaflet on this show a while back, so I won't read the whole thing again, but with reference to Devin's email, I want to hit a few high points again, and I quote, "The basic rule of homecoming is simple. Plan and save. Don't show up on somebody's doorstep here with $100 in your pocket and the T-shirt on your back expecting to be taken in, fed, housed, and supported by comrades who in most cases are as strapped as you are. Don't expect a free ride. We understand that some people coming to the homeland might not be in a strong financial situation, especially since we're in the middle of the Obama Depression. Nonetheless, we expect you to pull your own weight like the early pioneers did. With the economy the way it is, realizing that it will probably get worse before it gets better, the party knows that some of you will need help when you get here. That being said, you need to realize that none of us are rich and we can't provide money or accommodation beyond occasional temporary overnighters in someone's guest room. Pastor Butler had a bunkhouse. The party does not as yet, and it will be some time before such a facility exists, if ever. You must come prepared to become self-sufficient as soon as possible. By doing this, you will open things up for another person to be helped in your place, as well as take the strain off the people helping you to get settled. We have not yet won the War of Independence, and the homeland is still part of the United States and the capitalist system. You must come prepared to compete in the job market. You must spruce yourself up, cut your hair, hide your tattoos, wear a nice suit for job interviews, and if necessary, be prepared to kiss some muggle ass for a job, just like you would anywhere else. Accept this and be prepared for it. Bring warm winter clothes with you when you come, or enough money to buy them once you arrive. White people have become very climatically soft over the years, Californians and Southerners especially, demanding that it be hot enough to grow a palm tree in their room. Now that's not natural for white people. You will be coming home to the kind of climate that our Northern European ancestors lived in, and which helped make us a great race. Prepare for it. Bring transportation, a motor vehicle which is mechanically sound and functional, not some old beater on its last legs that rolls up burning oil and needs $1,000 worth of work. It is true that the major urban areas in the Northwest homeland do operate extensive public transportation services. You can live in the cities without a car, although not comfortably. But in the two primary settlement areas we've got so far, and most of the other areas in the Northwest, a fairly long commute to and from work is standard, and transportation is an absolute necessity. Okay, end quote there. Right, Devin, I'm sure you get the picture. Here is my own brief guide to anyone, T-shirt youth or otherwise, to migration. I myself arrived in Centralia, Washington in May of 2002 with around $3,000 in my pocket, as I recall, and a functioning automobile. I had no place to stay, but I found an apartment within about 3 days, and I had enough money for the deposit and the first month's rent, and also for a deposit and hookup of basic utilities like phone and electricity, although nowadays one doesn't even need a landline phone since everybody uses cells, and nobody uses dial-up for computers anymore. What you will need is internet hookup, unless you have Wi-Fi. Now, this will give you an idea how much things have advanced technologically, even in 12 years. What you do now, Devin, and all you T-shirt youth out there, is you land the best-paying job you can there in Michigan, kissing whatever nigger or Jew ass you have to kiss to get it. This is important, and you need to learn the self-discipline to conform so that you can survive and do your racial duty. It will probably be minimum wage and probably doing something very unpleasant. You will keep this job when you get it, Devin. You will show up for work every day, on time, sober, and not hungover. You will do what you are told, how you are told to do it, yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir, because that is how millions of white males must survive in politically correct America. You will not pick fights with niggers and spicks and assholes at work and get yourself fired. You will not throw tantrums at work and walk off the job because you can't cope. I don't know about Devin's case, but a lot of young white boys are very brittle and highly strung, and they just can't cope with the bullshit, which is one reason why they retreat into World of Warcraft every night to escape. You're not going to escape into World of Warcraft, Devin. You're escaping to the Northwest homeland, and so you will keep that minimum wage shit job, and you will draw that paycheck every week. And lest anyone ask, this is pretty much how I myself lived from 1976 to about 2005 when I had my stroke, with a few intervals of full-time racial work and time on the run in Europe, true, but basically that's it. I have been everything from a taxi driver to a pizza cook to a madrugadore hanging out with the Mexicans at the convenience store in Carver at 6 a.m. looking for day labor, as well as every type of cubicle dweller in a pastel shirt and a tie that you can think of. So, listen to me, Devin. I've been there, done that, and I know whereof I speak. During this time, you will save your money, Devin. You will stash every penny that does not go toward your immediate physical survival and getting you to and from work every day. You will disconnect any cable TV you may have, and you will sell the television set. The only thing you need during this part of your life is a public library card and a radio so that you can listen to news broadcasts and the local classical station, or in my case, Rush Limbaugh. You will do this for 1 year. You will not drink any beer or other alcohol during this time because your homecoming is more important. You will not smoke cigarettes because they are murderously expensive and your homecoming is more important. And besides, it's a filthy, dangerous habit. And yes, in this case, do as I say, not as I do. Just because I'm stupid in that way doesn't mean you have to be. And besides, I'm already home. You will work as many hours as you can. You will come home and cook yourself up some Campbell's chunky soup or something, and then you will read a book and go to bed and get up in the morning and go back to work. And at the end of the week, you will bank every surplus penny in that chintzy little paycheck. The only expenditure that you will permit yourself when your year is up is buying any winter clothes you lack and getting your car in mechanical shape for a long trip to follow your forefathers over prairies and mountains and get yourself where the hell you're supposed to be. You will then clean out your grubby little apartment, toss the landlord the keys, get in that car, and roll out onto the interstate heading northwest. Okay, third Halloween music break. Not sure who this is, but here's one for all of you H.P. Lovecraft aficionados. It's a tender ballad of Cthulhu and the Old Ones called Before He Rips Off My Face.
This one, it is Blurry by Puddle of Mud, rewritten as Bloody, about a Call of Cthulhu expedition gone terribly wrong.
And this is, of course, in honor of our dear friend, Carissa, who annually throws the Cthulhu Christmas party.
So bloody and everyone so dead. My colleagues and the cultists, that creature turned them inside out. Oh shit, the damn things found me. I wish I had a gun. Tentacles surround me. I scream and then I run. I could have gone to Harvard or maybe MIT, but I studied at Miskatonic. Now something studies me. It's watching me from somewhere outside of space and time. It's on its way to find me. I need an elder sign. So I try to get away. I try to get away before it eats my face and then sucks out my brain. I try to get away. I try to get away before it eats my face. There's something in the water, there's something underground. I shows up in my nightmares, I think it's driving me insane. It knows too much about me, oh God, what have I done? Tentacles surround me, I scream and then I run. I could have gone to Harvard or maybe MIT, but I studied at Miskatonic. Now something studies me. It's watching me from somewhere outside of space and time. It's on its way to find me. I need an elder sign. So I try to get away. I try to get away before it eats my face and then sucks out my brain. So I try to get away. I try to get away before it eats my face. Books that I never should have read. Research that made me lose my sand. Words that I never should have said. Too awful for the mind of man. Things that I never should have learned. Elder gods and their dreadful reign. Books that I really wish I'd burned. Too awful for the human brain. So I try to get
try to get away. I try to get away before it eats my face.
Oh, well.
Okay, time enough for one more email, so we'll get back to the Northwest Constitution. Dear HAC, I may be just splitting hairs here, but financially I thought there needs to be a way to handle money for charities in the Northwest Republic. There is going to be a long list of charity organizations that private persons need to provide for, that the state should not be responsible for, but pooling money to handle these issues and paying these people for their time might violate the paid religious service part of the Constitution. Here are some real-world examples of exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, so let's say that a bunch of old believers get together and have the state declare a section of forest a sacred grove. All well and good. However, it's clearly not the state's job to maintain the grove, it's the local old believers' job. Now, typically, the local believers would just pool their financial resources and solicit donations to raise funds to buy the necessary gear to maintain the area and pay for improvements. There needs to be a way to do this without being in violation of the Constitution. Secondly, same issue, different group. Let's say a bunch of Wiccans and Christians who like animals a lot wanted to pool some financial resources to set up shelters to house animals for farmers who couldn't care for them anymore. They'd be buying land, paying people to care for the animals, buying food for the animals, etc. I really don't have any other issues. I would, however, like to see the word interfere defined better as it applies to the gun rights issue. I would define taxation as interference, since taxation can be used as a tool to disrupt gun manufacturers and sellers. However, making gun sale and manufacture a tax-free business is unfair to other businesses. Signed, Emmanuel in Florida. Right, I think you need to bear in mind the purpose of that particular provision of the Constitution, which is to eliminate the professional clergy as a class, as Marxist as that sounds. But it's pretty much on the mark. Now, at the risk of dropping myself well and truly in the boiling poop with some people, the fact is that Karl Marx wasn't such a dummy as far as his analysis of Western capitalist society and how it works goes. It's just when he came to his solutions, he was nutty as a fruitcake. As far as the actual analysis goes, he was pretty spot on. And yes, Virginia, in the Western world, there are, and for a long time have been, such things as classes. Classes have been around since the Renaissance and even before, although in the Middle Ages there were only four of them. The nobility, the clergy, the small merchant and commercial class, and then everybody else, which is about 90% of the population, i.e. the peasants. The first urban classes, as Marx would recognize them, were the craft guilds of the medieval cities. And then when the Industrial Revolution came along in the late 18th century, you got the first modern working class, so forth and so on, along with such other charming classes as lawyers and a professional intelligentsia. Marx was also right in that people in a class structure tend to act in their class interests against the others. In 1984, George Orwell put it even more simply, "There have always been three classes. The high, the middle, and the low, and the interests of all three classes are mutually exclusive and oppositional to one another. The high want to remain where they are, the middle class wants to exchange places with the high, and the low want to abolish all class distinctions, which will never happen." And then in the 19th and 20th centuries, you had the poisonous contaminants of the Jews and the race issue thrown in as well. And I'm rambling again. Okay. One thing, though, that Marx and Lenin, and especially Stalin, got right was that in order to seize human history by the throat and wrench it by force onto another track, which is what we're going to have to do, in our case, we're going to have to force history back to where we went wrong, is that certain classes and races of people need to be completely eliminated from the equation, completely removed from national life and from the political process. Adolf Hitler understood this as well, and he often said things of this nature in his writings and his speeches, and up until 1939, Germany was well on the way, not to eliminating all class differences, which is probably impossible with human beings, but in reducing or returning society to the classes which are natural and organic to the Aryan racial personality, pretty much the way we lived for millennia, the chieftains, the warriors, the craftsmen, and the farmers. Now, this was before Christianity threw that first unnatural class in there, the professional priesthood or clergy. Now, this is why a lot of the early Protestants in Germany and Northern Europe referred to the Catholic countries to the south of them as priest-ridden. And once again, I'm rambling way, way off the track here. The purpose of that section of the Constitution is to eliminate a class of individuals whose interests do not necessarily coincide with those of the ethno-state, and who've demonstrated in the past 100 years that they are very susceptible to subversion and transmutation into an enemy of the Aryan people through the infiltration of things like Zionism and buggery. Over the past century, homosexuality has been rife throughout the Christian ministries of all persuasions, and I've always figured that was the first weakness that the Jews used to shoehorn their way into the church, but we won't get into that or we'll be here all night. Now, you're right. The bulk of the actual charitable work in the Northwest Republic needs to be done by private individuals acting out of civic duty, although hopefully we'll eliminate most of the problems that cause people to need charity. Now, no one is saying that religious groups can't raise money for charities or to put a new roof on their church or have bake sales to buy prosthetic limbs for amputees or whatever. They just can't pay their preacher for doing it, and they'll probably have to pay property taxes on their church, which is another way we prevent the amassing of massive amounts of wealth and property by religious organizations. Make sure they keep on worshiping God and not mammon. In the Northwest Republic, the age-old conflict between church and state will be finally resolved. The state wins. When the minister spends 40 hours a week working at a regular job, and his off time holding religious services and organizing bake sales and so forth and so on, then that's what he's supposed to be doing. Not using all that leisure time on his hands he'd have if he were paid to stick his nose into things that don't concern him, like politics. The law will then have served its purpose. As far as taxation on firearms, so long as the First Amendment of the Northwest Constitution is generally accepted by both the state and the racially homogenous white population of the Republic, and the right to keep and bear arms is not constantly under question, constantly under assault and challenge like it is today, then I, myself, personally, would have no objection to paying a reasonable tax of 15 cents on a box of 50 ammunition cartridges or something like that. As I pointed out in Freedom Sons, in a society with no income tax and no property tax on homesteads, the government has to raise money somehow. That's what things like the state liquor and tobacco and marijuana monopolies would be for, our version of bake sales. But I know a lot of the hardcore gun people listening to this will get all upset at that idea, and all I can say is that it's one of the many things we're going to have to sort out at the Constitutional Convention after we finally break brave and run these American dogs out of our country. Let's get that done first, shall we? Let's break brave and then sit down and see what we come up with. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. I'll tell you what, though. I think I'll close this out with one last Halloween song from back around 1973, I think. The only cannibalism song ever to make it to the top 40 for a few weeks, anyway. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856. Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom. This is The Boys.